Hello and welcome to the Margin Driving Podcast 130. My name is Terry Frost and it's Hammer Time. This time around, I'm doing two Hammer horror movies from the 1970s, in fact, the early 1970s. The first one is from 1972 and it is Demons of the Mind, a very obscure Hammer film starring Shane Bryant, Gillian Hills, Robert Hardy and Patrick McGee. Then we go back one year to 1971 for a slightly more interesting movie, and it is Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, starring Ralph Bates and Martine Beswick, and that one is a lot of fun. It talks a lot about gender roles in a very kind of weird way. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we will put the hammer down. Martian Driving Podcast is a two-weekly podcast about science fiction, fantasy, and other genres, cinema and television. From George Méliès to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Extended Universe, anything's up for grabs in this podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. And if you want to give feedback, you can go to feedbackpaleo@gmail.com and leave a voicemail or an email message. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, adult concepts and words may turn up. So if you're going to be listening to them with kids around, put on the headphones. Or if you can't do that, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do. Okay, so how has everyone been? I've been pretty busy since last time I threw carbon dioxide at this microphone on the Martian Driving Podcast, because we went to Sydney, as I mentioned in the previous podcast we were going to do. And that was kind of fun. I talked about it in Paleo Cinema, but I'm not sure about the overlap between the two podcasts, so I'll just go through it a bit. Visited my mum twice. Well, she came to me and had lunch with us on the Saturday, because we're there for an extended weekend. And on Sunday, we went and visited her at her nursing home. And there's been a lot of deterioration in her dementia. She's ambulatory and walks around quite fast with her walker, but the cognitive decline is noticeably different than when I was there in October, so that was quite sad. I've talked about it on Facebook as well, so I won't go into too many details, but there were some good things there too. Caught up with the family for my nephew Billy's 8th birthday, which was a lot of fun, and I got to show Sal a lot more around Sydney's Chinatown, because we had a boutique hotel right in the centre of Chinatown. So we did things like, well, I found all the nice food courts under street level in Chinatown, and we ate hawker food there. My favourite hawker food at the moment is the national dish of Malaysia, which is a nasi lemak, which has got rice, chicken, maybe some beef on the side, a bit of a salad, some sambal chili sauce to spice things up, a big mound of rice, and a little kind of side thing for texture, which is made up of peanuts and dried fish. And it's really healthy food. It's really yummy food. It's got a nice kick to it. And in the food courts downstairs off Dixon Street, you don't go to the posh restaurants. If you're ever in Sydney, in Dixon Street and going to Chinatown, don't go in all the restaurants where they have people standing out the front ready to show you a menu. Find the little stairs that go downstairs and go to the food courts, because for $12 we got a meal with a little broth along with it, and it's fantastic hawker food. That's where you're going to find a lot of the Asian students eating, because they can get really good food from home. We have a lot of students who come over to Sydney particularly, and the universities to learn from other countries. And so they all go there for kind of cheap, nourishing food, and it's really great. So we did that. We didn't get to see much else. We didn't get to catch up with a lot of the lovely people we know in Sydney. But having done the family thing, having done the Chinatown thing, it was a pretty full-on 4 or 5 days, and then this weekend, I'm actually recording this podcast a day late because we socialised in town with a whole bunch of friends, Tim and Narelle. Tim's a travel writer, Narelle writes fiction, and a bunch of other people in a nice little kind of courtyard bar off the main drags in Melbourne CBDs. That's the thing. Here's the trick with cities. Main streets and big touristy places aren't where you go. You find the little interstitial things and the little places that are off the beaten track. Talk to locals. The closer they live to the place, the better. and you're going to find where the interesting stuff is. And it's never on a main street. It's always in an alley or up a flight of stairs or down a flight of stairs. But the cool places in any city aren't where the tourists go. So that's just a tip for you. So we had that, which also means that I haven't had time to watch a terrible amount of stuff over the last 2 weeks. But having said that, I'm going to bring up the Letterboxd anyway and just see what I can find there. And I'm scrolling down, which is always interesting for listeners just to hear somebody messing around on the internet. I did watch a few things. I watched Annihilation, the Alex Garland movie based on Jeff Vandermeer's novel. And I want to go watch it again before I really talk about it, because like Stalker, the 1979 Andrei Tarkovsky film, to which it owes a little bit of a nod, it's one of those movies that you need to see a couple of times to really process all of what's going on. Yes, you can find all the stuff in the commentary that's out there on social media and other media, but I really want to kind of process it for myself rather than doing that. And, yeah, I think it's a worthwhile movie. It's a movie that doesn't spoon feed you. You've got to go out there and hunt down what the movie's about and skin and gut it yourself. But I think it's definitely worth checking out if you haven't already. Then when I was up in Sydney, I picked up a $7 Blu-ray, and I'm very tempted every time I see a $7 Blu-ray in a store. I picked it up at Lawson's down the bottom end of Pitt Street. And if you ever get to Sydney, Lawson's is the place to go to find weird shit. And that Blu-ray is a kind of bad but good medieval Knights of the Round Table kind of movie. Prince Valiant, starring Robert Wagner. But it's also got an interesting supporting cast in it. You've got Sterling Hayden playing a knight in a very un-Sterling Hayden role. You've got the bad guy being played by James Mason. You've got Janet Leigh in there, Deborah Padgett, a whole bunch of interesting character actors from the time. Victor McLaughlin's in there playing a Viking. It really is very much a Hollywood Knights of the Round Table kind of movie, based on a long running comic strip. But yeah, it was kind of a bit of fun and a little bit of kind of chewing gum viewing to just kill some time when I wasn't doing anything else. Then I watched a Netflix movie, which is really kind of transgressively bad, called Game Over Man, which stars Adam Devine and the other guys from the TV series Workaholics. It's kind of like a slacker version of Die Hard, and it's got lots of celebrity cameos in it. It's got severed dicks and all sorts of other things, and some interesting character actors in it as well. People like Daniel Stern, who people remember from Home Alone more than being the kind of ingenue love interest in Alan Arkush's Get Crazy. But he's in there as well, and a whole bunch of other people. So it's very kind of meta and referential to other bits of cinema. And, you might want to check it out. There's a lot of used condoms in the movie. I'll be honest with you about that. But it's transgressive comedy. It's not wasting your time. And there's some very funny moments, and they kind of do run with the concepts in some very interesting directions, which I kind of enjoyed. And for a Saturday night when I was a little bit tired from running around doing things, it wasn't a bad thing to watch. But that's pretty much all I've been watching since I actually podcasted Paleo Cinema Late. So I did that about Wednesday last week. So hasn't been a lot of time between then and now to watch a hell of a lot, which is kind of okay, but I did watch the two movies of which I am going to speak in this podcast, being Demons of the Mind, which I hadn't seen before. It was one of the rare Hammer films from that era that I haven't checked out sometime in the last 50 years. But it was an interesting one to see, and I understand why it's a little bit obscure, but I kind of enjoyed it. Then one of the great Hammer horror films from the early 1970s, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, which I really did enjoy, and I've got a few things to say about that too. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to do Demons of the Mind first. So I'll take that break, play you the trailer, and then talk about why this is a very atypical Hammer horror film of the early 1970s.
They say they love us. I could kill them for what they've done to you.
Shh. Oh, Elizabeth, I don't know what madness is upon us.
Friedrich, Klaus, they're free!
What madness lies like a curse upon this family. What secret binds brother and sister in a conspiracy of fear?
Elizabeth! Come back!
Only a thin knife edge separates reality from illusion.
Elizabeth!
Sanity from madness.
I'm not Elizabeth! I'm not!
Amy.
The torments of the flesh from the demons of the mind. It is no ordinary game these children play, but a ritual as old as the Druids, as profane as a witch's Sabbath.
What's wrong?
It's a warning of death.
But it's only a ritual.
No. No.
But it is a human madness that pursues her. She will not be the first victim, nor the last, of the demons of the mind.
This place reeks of madness and decay. Elizabeth's not mad now, but you and this house will drive her mad.
You may have thought you were trying to protect them, but without understanding, you have been destroying them.
It's been a nightmare.
We're not working yet.
No one need ever know of this horror.
The world will be a better place without me. And it won't even know that you died.
Root out evil and destruction!
Please, I must go to her.
Emil, Elizabeth's safe. No one's going to hurt her. And you're in no danger.
Demons of the Mind is a 1972 British horror film. It's part of Hammer's stable of British horror films. And it's definitely in my sweet spot because Hammer films for me, were ever since I first started watching movies, were the go-tos. When they became available, I was there. I've mentioned this before, but back in the 70s for a brief time, the Star Cinema in Bondi Junction in Sydney turned itself into a horror movie cinema, complete with dummies dressed up like the Mummy and Dracula and Frankenstein's monster and all sorts of things. And I travelled enormous distances to go and see Hammer horror films there. And it was really cool for me because I could go down every Saturday and just see these movies which otherwise weren't available. This is before VHS even, and definitely before streaming. So these are the kinds of movies that I've got such a nostalgic fondness for, even the ones I haven't seen. Yes, the acting can be hammy and bombastic at times. Yes, the Kensington Gore fake blood they use is vivid and nothing at all like real blood. And yes, I partly went to see them in case there was nudity. But then I was young then, and I won't travel to see a movie just because of nudity anymore, because I have streaming services. And this one is pretty replete with nudity. I was a bit surprised by that because I wasn't aware of it. But anyway, on with the movie. I'll give you the synopsis from, he said, looking this up, IMDb, which is a pretty good one. Baron Zorn, played by Robert Hardy, has his teenage children locked up and drugged, fearing that his insane wife passed along a congenital curse to them before her own suicide. The daughter Elizabeth escapes for a brief tryst with a local before being recaptured and subjected to a bleeding process to draw out the bad blood. Her brother Emil keeps trying to escape but is thwarted time and again by his aunt Hilda, who runs the house like a prison. One reason the siblings have to be kept apart is their incestuous attraction for each other. Local women are being murdered in the woods and the superstitious peasants think demons are responsible. A wandering priest dedicates himself to root out the evil. He's played by Michael Horden, but he isn't taken seriously. Arriving at the castle are two more interested parties, a scientist huckster called Falkenberg, played by Patrick McGee, who stands to make a small fortune with his strange apparatus can cure the children of their inherited evil, and a younger man, Carl, who simply wants to rescue Elizabeth. As more murders mount, things get serious. So that's basically it. This movie is a bit of a mashup of a whole bunch of things. There are a whole bunch of plot threads that are thrown together, and they don't necessarily hold. There's a pre-Christian ritual to ward off evil that the village performs using a kind of scarecrowy figure, and the children with little axes chop up the figure and throw it into the fire. So they've got that. There's a little bit Wicker Man in a way, but nothing really comes of it. There's the over-the-top gothic stuff with the two imprisoned brother and sister with the unhappy family background and their father, who Robert Hardy plays very, very hammily and over the top, is basically as mad as a meat axe, using any kind of quack remedy he can find to try to cure them, including bleeding his daughter, which is seen in quite a graphic process, and it looks like there's some real kind of slashing of the flesh and blood that occurs in there. We get the sister, Hilda, the sister-in-law of Baron Zorn, played by Yvonne Mitchell, who is probably one of the more complex characters. And Yvonne Mitchell is a fine actor, so she really gave it more than it needed. Then we've got some other people in there. Paul Jones plays Carl, the young man who's trying to rescue Elizabeth, who's played by the way, Paul Jones was the main protagonist in Peter Watkins' Privilege, so you know him from that. And he was also a member of Manfred Mann's band for a while, I think. Yeah, I got that right. Morris will be proud of me. So, so we've got Paul Jones playing that role. We've also got a couple of Australian connections in this film. And for Australians, it's always good to get a couple of Australian connections in. First off, Kenneth J. Warren, who plays the henchman of Baron Zorn, Klaus, is an Australian actor. And he's the kind of shaved-headed, hard guy that we see in there. And he died very early age. He died at the age of 43. That's a little bit unusual, even for those days. Let's see if I can find anything about how he died. But not really, no. I can't find anything about that. But he's in there. And also, the director of the piece, a guy called Peter Sykes, is an Australian. He went to England in the early 1960s to work for the BBC and continued on making a few films and also doing a lot of work on episodic television. So there's the Australian connections for this one. I'll give you an Australian connection for the other movie as well. In fact, a couple of them probably. But Demons of the Mind is that weird mashup. You've got the villagers, you've got the insane priest played by Michael Horden, you've got the kind of gothic incestuous brother and sister in there with the mad father, you've got the crazy mountebank Falkenberg, played very hammily again by Patrick McGee, not Patrick McNee from the Avengers, but Patrick McGee, the Irish actor who was also in The Final Program, the Jerry Cornelius adaptation that was done a couple of years after this. We see Robert Brown, who played M in some James Bond movies after the death of Bernard Lee, turning up as an innkeeper. And just a lot of familiar faces. Now, the woman playing Elizabeth's interesting too, Gillian Hills. Originally, the role was going to be played by Marianne Faithfull, but because she had a drug problem at the time, they couldn't get insurance coverage for her, so Gillian Hills got on board. Now, she had a brief career in the 60s and 1970s as an actor before retiring from the industry and becoming an illustrator. She did the cover illustration for the first edition of The Colour Purple, for instance. So she kind of went on to have a very different career. But she had a career before acting as well. In the early 1960s, from about 1960 to 1965, she was a pop star in France and was discovered by Serge Gainsbourg, as indeed were a lot of young, beautiful women at the time. And she did a whole bunch of different pop songs in France under the Yeah Yeah kind of genre. I'll see if I can find a Gillian Hills song, and I'll play it at the end of the podcast. So, yeah, she kind of had some interesting career changes there. This was her third last movie. She did kind of an Italian movie and from what seems to be a Spanish movie after this. So she didn't have a great career in film, though she was in Blown Up, the Antonioni film with David Hemmings, and in Big Girl in 1960. So she did have a bit of a career for about 14 years before she changed tracks, moved to the United States and became an illustrator. But we get a fair bit of nudity from her, and I think her acting is pretty good in this one too. She was a better actor than I think she was given opportunities to show, because, well, the industry at the time chewed up and spat out a lot of young, beautiful women, regardless of their talent. And this is, of course, 40, 50 years before the Me Too thing. But there's no doubt that they were pressured in various ways at various times. And a lot of people jumped out of the industry because they couldn't put up with the bullshit. And there's no evidence one way or the other that Gillian Hills was a part of the Me Too movement, in the sense of having been harassed, but I'm always wary of young, beautiful women who have a short career in cinema, in the sense that they probably either the role stopped coming because they stopped giving out, if they ever did, or else they kind of grew older and weren't considered for roles because of the increasing number of birthdays they had. So she's quite good in this one. I really like her. But tonally, this film is very different than so many other Hammer films. At the start, we see Elizabeth's first escape, and we don't know anything about her, anything about her situation, except that she's being chased by people. And we see her meeting up with a young, handsome woodsman who she's scared of at first, and she collapses because she's been obviously on the run for a little bit. And he nurses her back to health. They make love, and then she's captured by her family again, and we never see that guy again. Now, Shane Bryant, who plays her brother, interesting actor. He had a long career. In fact, he's still acting. He's actually a friend of mine on Facebook, oddly enough. I just follow the later part of his career. He does live in Sydney. He moved to Australia with his wife, Wendy, years ago, and he was in a movie called Gallipoli in 2014, which is not the Mel Gibson Gallipoli, but another one, the miniseries, in fact. So he's kind of still acting to a certain extent. I know he's had some health issues recently, but he's moved over to this side of town. He was in a few other interesting films. The Picture of Dorian Gray, 1973. Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell, another Hammer film in 74. And he was in Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter, amongst other things. Hawk the Slayer, the 1981 Lady Chatterley's Lover, the Naked Civil Servant, the John Hurt movie about Quentin Crisp. Was it a movie or a TV thing? I'm not sure, but in 1975 he was in that. So he has had a career as a character actor. Very beautiful young man. He's got kind of a slightly fey look about him in this film. It was one of his early roles because it comes up as introducing, even though he was in another movie called Straight On Till Morning in 72 as well, which is another Hammer film. I don't know whether it was made before or after. I'm just going to kind of cross check this one. I won't be a sec. It came out before Demons of the Mind, though. He does have an introductory credit in Demons of the Mind. But Shane Bryant, you know, fine character actor there. Yvonne Mitchell had a long and distinguished career as an actor as well. She plays Hilda the aunt in this one. And she's been in a few interesting things. She died in 1979, unfortunately. She also did a lot of Shakespeare in Stratford, which is kind of cool, with Michael Redgrave, Harry Andrews, Robert Shaw and other fine actors. And she does, as I said, give the role of Hilda the aunt a lot more than is strictly necessary for a Hammer level of gig. So you've got to admire her for that. As I said, this movie is a crazy mashup. We get some extended full frontal nudity on one of the young women who were in the villages around the Baron Zorn's castle. This is a really weird film from that point of view, because the villagers all seem to be character actors and young, beautiful, blonde women. And we get some very prolonged nudity in some of the bits of this. Hammer, of course, decided slightly later than some other film studios to embrace the increasing amount of nudity and the increasing censorship freedom of the time, so that you get movies around this time like Lust for a Vampire and The Vampire Lovers and other movies, which do show a fair bit of female flesh, and which probably prolonged the studio's success for a few years, but eventually got to the stage where the low budgets and some fad following kind of things like The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, where they jumped onto the kung fu craze and tried to mix it in with their standard vampire stuff, which wasn't particularly successful or particularly well done, kind of saw the end of Hammer as a studio. It's come back now and it's getting a lot of love from a lot of people because the movies are, which are owned by Pathé, I think, are being redistributed and are starting to get some critical attention. We get them here in kind of groups. There's no announcement, there's no PR that I can see in Australia when the Blu-rays of Hammer horror films come out. But over the last few years, we've had kind of 10 of them being released at once, and suddenly you'll see them on the shelves at, say, JB Hi-Fi. And that's how I picked this one up. I got a whole bunch of really cool and interesting Hammer horror films from my local JB, which is a big chain here, which does give a lot of love to genre works. Amongst other things, they sell computers, they sell kitchen appliances, they sell console games and PC games, they sell music, and they sell a lot of movies. And because they've got such large retail space, they've got a bit of room there to throw in some things that genre lovers will like. And suddenly there was a massive influx of Hammer horror films there, which I picked up, and they were selling them for $15 or so, and buy two, get one free. So essentially you'd be paying $30 for three of them. So you're getting deep Blu-rays of these films for $10 each, which was a nice deal and still is. And the movies themselves have usually a short 15-minute documentary where they talk to a few experts about the films, usually the same experts. So they're not putting a lot of effort and a lot of money into the extras, but it does just give you a bit of context to the film, and the fact that they're released at all is a nice thing for people who like genre films. And having them released in a format where I can just pop it into the Xbox rather than popping it into the multi-zone Blu-ray player is even easier still for me. The film was filmed, the exteriors at least, were filmed at a place called Wycurse Park House in East Sussex, which is the same house they use for The Legend of Hell House a couple of years later. And it's a kind of gothic folly of a house. It's got large windows and a crenellated top, and it really does look like the sort of place that a character like Baron Zorn would live in. And it really does add to the atmosphere. It adds to the production value of the film, using that kind of a place and adding little flourishes, like the fact that outside the house there are a couple of hunting falcons sitting on a pole outside the house and just being kind of tethered there gives you an idea that it's a house full of menace and the owner of the house is predatory in some way, which we do find out. There's also a serial killer subplot where one of the characters murders beautiful young women and then spreads rose petals around the place in a style very reminiscent of American Beauty. So we've got that as a subplot, and that leads us to the thing that you always want to see in this kind of movie at some stage, which is a bit of a touchstone, and I went yay when I saw it. And that is a whole bunch of peasants with pitchforks and torches coming to take someone down. You've got to love that in this kind of movie, and indeed I do. But the interesting twist in this one is the peasants who have the pitchforks and torches and who kind of come to the house of Baron Zorn to make things right are actually right. They're not just attacking out of ignorance and superstition. They've shed the superstition and they've gone with the evidence, and they are provided by Michael Horden's character, who's as mad as a meat axe. He's a mad religious nut, But he shows them evidence of what's going on before they all go berserk and head up to the house with pitchforks and torches. So for a change, the pitchforks and torches peasants are righteous. And I kind of like that. I like that slight twist to the cliche of that kind of thing. And that ends up with some very gory stuff. There's a bit with a burning cross, which is used in a very unusual way. There's an amputation. There's a whole bunch. This movie does not end well for any of the characters whatsoever. The characters who don't die are insane or are handling an insane person. And shit just gets crazy real towards the end of this one, and it's very nihilistic in that sense, in the same way that a movie like Witchfinder General is nihilistic at the end, and that doesn't end well for any of the characters. This movie is the same way. I think the pacing is off, the writing is off, but somehow it builds up this really strange, creepy, distasteful, toxic kind of atmosphere with a slow menace about it. And it's that kind of atmosphere is what makes the movie really work for me. There's also the fact that Falkenberg, who's a kind of charlatan pseudo-scientist who says he's a doctor of the mind, has a kind of hypnotism machine, which consists of a whole bunch of test tubes in a barrel and a whole bunch of kind of curved bits of metal pointing at whoever the subject of the thing is, and then a candle on a rotating arm to hypnotize that person. So he's got this crazy and unlike anything else you've seen in a movie, hypnotic machine to hypnotize Baron Zorn and to kind of find out what's going on. And it looks like it's been put together fairly quickly by the production design people, but it looks different than a lot of machines you'd see of this kind. And that, too, adds an extra layer of texture to this movie, which gives us everything that's on the label. It really does work from that point of view that it's not a typical Hammer. It's more of a kind of gothic mystery. There was a subplot to do with one of the characters being a werewolf, which was discarded during production, but there are a couple of allusions to it in some of the dialogue. So they've kind of thrown everything into the mix, whipped it up in the blender and put it out there. And I think a tighter script might well have helped. The original idea for the thing was by a musical composer called Frank Godwin, who had a script called Blood Will Have Blood. And that was then kind of pumped up and changed and knocked into some kind of shape by a screenwriter called Christopher Wicking, who had a few other interesting movies under his belt as a writer. He did the 1981 Lady Chatterley's Lover. He wrote the screenplay to The Devil a Daughter, another Hammer movie. He also did the screenplay to Blood in the Mummy's Tomb, Murders in the Rue Morgue, and Cry of the Banshee, and Scream Again, which is a movie I've really got to do for the podcast because that one's fucking crazy. That's from 1970, directed by Gordon Hassler, and has Vincent Price, Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing in it, which is pretty much all you need to know. But Demons of the Mind, yeah, I'm a bit surprised that I haven't seen it before. Maybe it hasn't been available before. There's always that possibility here in Australia that it was never released in any kind of buyable or rentable format. But I'm kind of glad that I watched it. I'm not sure how many more times I'll watch it, but it is, as I said, atypical because of the mood and because of the slightly ramshackled structure of it. But if you're a Hammer completist, or if you just want to see a Hammer movie with a lot of blood, gore and attractive female nudity, then this might be the movie for you. So I'm going to take a break now, and then I'm going to talk about a somewhat different movie. Still Hammer, still bloody and gory, and that is Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, starring Ralph Bates and Martine Beswick. And here, of course, is the trailer.
Everyone knows there are two sides to the infamous Dr. Jekyll. By day, the man. By night, the monster.
Put a woman in your life, a good woman, and one day you'll wake up and you'll see A changed man.
Now, Hammer believe you too are ready for a change. An absolutely complete change.
This is the testament of Dr. Henry Jekyll. Male. Male. Male.
It's Hyde, isn't it? How is your brother?
He hasn't been himself of late.
This is the new Dr. Jekyll, the most evil woman you'll ever see. This is the sensuous Sister Hyde, the most evil man you'll ever meet.
Stay away from her. She means you great harm.
Why?
I just feel it, that's all.
Dr. Jekyll, Sister Hyde. Man or woman? Or both? In this film, you will actually see the sinister Dr. Jekyll change in mind and body into the totally evil Sister Hyde.
It is I who exist, Dr. Jekyll, not you. It is I who will be rid of you. Rid of you! Rid of you!
Hammer invites you to share the agony of a man whose body is possessed by a strange passion to murder and beyond.
They must be female, no more than 20 years old.
There will be a different kind of victim tonight. And then the tug of war will be ended between us. Fascinating situation, don't you think? It'll be interesting to see who wins.
Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde was the third version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that Hammer did. The first one was a movie from 1959 called The Ugly Duckling, with Bernard Breslau playing the titular character. The movie The Nutty Professor owed a shit ton to The Ugly Duckling, by the way. Then there was The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll with Paul Massey in the early 60s, and then they left off until Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde. The movie was directed by Roy Ward Baker, who had done a few other things for Hammer previously, and it stars Martine Beswick as Sister Hyde. She had previously been in From Russia with Love as one of the gypsy girls fighting for James Bond's attention in the gypsy camp in Turkey. And done a number of things. She was actually born in Jamaica. And we also have Ralph Bates, who was being groomed as a replacement for Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing by Hammer as Dr. Jekyll. That didn't pan out too well long-term for his career. He did a few things for Hammer: Taste the Blood of Dracula, The Horror of Frankenstein, Lust for a Vampire, and this one. And then went on to do some TV series and other things. Unfortunately, he died quite an early age of pancreatic cancer, at the age of 51. And there's a pancreatic cancer research fund in his name as a registered charity in the UK. But apparently he was well-liked as an actor and had a decent career up until his illness in 1991. The supporting cast is pretty good too. We've got Gerald Sim, who usually played lawyers, bankers and barristers, as Professor Robertson, who's a bit of a mentor to Dr. Jekyll and is also a lecherous older man who does frolic with chorus girls and ladies of the night and has an eye for the women. So he's playing a little bit of a different role for Gerald Sim. You'll know his face when you see him in the movie. We also have Louis Fiander, an Australian actor. There's your Australian connection. Playing Howard Spencer, who lives upstairs with his mother, Mrs. Spencer, played by Dorothy Allison. Another Australian actor. Hammer horror films are replete with Australians. We also have the young daughter of Mrs. Spencer, Susan, played by an actor called Susan Broderick, who does really good in a role that's a little bit underwritten, but is quite crucial to the film. Now, the plot's fairly simple. Dr. Jekyll attempts to create an elixir of life using female hormones stolen from fresh corpses. He reasons that these hormones will wipe out all common diseases and extend his life so that he can do his research. Once he drinks the serum, however, he transforms into a beautiful but evil woman. He soon needs female hormones for his serum to maintain, so a number of London women meet bloody deaths. That's paraphrased from the IMDb. So this movie does some interesting things in the fact that it mashes up Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which was originally set in Edinburgh, by the way, if you go back to the Robert Louis Stevenson original. It mixes them up with Burke and Hare, which were also in Edinburgh, because I went through some of the tunnels they transported corpses through on a ghost tour in Edinburgh once upon a time, where I was cold, miserable, and we did it because Sally wanted to go on a ghost tour. And we didn't see any ghosts, of course, because, well, ghosts don't exist. But I did get a really nice glass of Scotch whiskey at the end of it. But so they mixed that up with the Burke and Hare body snatcher thing. Burke and Hare don't come to a good end in this movie. And they also mix it up with Jack the Ripper. So not only have you got Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you've got the true life story of Burke and Hare and the true life story of Jack the Ripper all mashed up into one thing in this film, which makes it, plus the gender bending, which makes it, to use a technical term, fucking crazy. The screenplay was by Brian Clemens, who had great success in the 1960s with the TV series The Avengers, and also wrote other things like Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter. Let's see what else we've got here. He did some Remington Steele episodes, some episodes of the New Avengers, The Protectors with Robert Vaughn, which was a TV series that I think Gerry Anderson did in the early 1970s. Let's have a look here. He did a lot. Adamant Lives, he did an episode of that. So he was well known for doing quirky and off-the-wall kind of projects, including the Highlander 2, The Quickening. I wouldn't put that on my resume, I'll tell you. So Clemens' idea was, what if Dr. Jekyll turned into a woman? Which is kind of a cool conceit. It gets complicated now, though, because we know a lot more about gender than they knew in 1971. And gender is much more indeterminate and fluid. There's not a binary there. We all know that. I'm going to be careful how I speak about this movie, too, because I really don't want to offend any trans people listening and any trans friends that I have. But this movie is kind of interesting from that point of view. The fact that Dr. Jekyll turns into Sister Hyde, and as Dr. Jekyll, he has a growing but kind of standoffish affection for Susan, who lives upstairs. But as Sister Hyde, he manipulates sexually and plays to and basically makes out with her brother. So there's a kind of sexual ambivalence there and a gender uncertainty about the character, because Sister Hyde isn't necessarily another person, as we know from the classic Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde stories, but another aspect of the original person. So somewhere within Dr. Jekyll is a female wanting to come out. And what's fairly clear is that that female is attracted to men, whereas Dr. Jekyll is, to some extent, attracted to women. So there's a kind of gender thing happening there, plus a thing of sexuality happening there, which the movie kind of lightly dances over, because there's a lot else going on. There's the body snatching stuff, and then there's the Jack the Ripper stuff when Burke and Hare get captured and killed, and we then move into the Jack the Ripper phase of the thing. So there's a lot of other stuff going on there, plus the relationship and the kind of dancing around with the brother and sister upstairs. So they don't take a lot of time, and I don't think they were particularly interested in deeply looking at the gender and sexuality issues that the movie creates. I think were there to be a remake of this film done now, it'd be a very different movie and done in a very different way, because our knowledge of these things has expanded over the last 40 odd years. But it also makes the movie much more interesting to look at from our point of view and to see how these kind of things were seen at the time. There is the fact that the Sister Hyde character is murderous and evil, to use a cliched and very theologically loaded term. But then so is Dr. Jekyll. He does murder people as himself well before Sister Hyde does. So that in itself shows that it's not Sister Hyde that's the evil, murderous character. It's in him to start with. He's willing to do whatever it takes to enable his research to continue, and probably subconsciously to get the female organs he needs to allow Sister Hyde to manifest. So there's probably a subconscious motive there, which makes the narrative a lot more interesting as well. The production design and production values here are pretty good. The streets of London are definitely a set. It's pretty clear that, and they use the usual London fog thing to disguise the fact that it is a fairly small street set that they use. But it's effective in a very kind of slightly abstracted way to portray what it needs to do. But it's got that beautiful set design stuff that Hammer was very good for, particularly Victorian era stuff. The lamps, for instance, and the chairs and tables and the wallpapers are all period authentic and really do. It's the interior sets that really sell this rather than the exterior ones. Then you've got Dr. Jekyll's lab, which has got the usual retorts and beakers and Bunsen burners and other bits and pieces there. This movie punches well above its weight, I think. There is the transformation sequence, which was made a lot of at the time, which is done basically with mirrors, where without a cut, we see Dr. Jekyll transform into Sister Hyde. It's slightly obvious from our point of view. If you're pretty savvy as far as movies are concerned, you can pick how it's done, but it's done cleverly. They wanted to do it in camera, and they do it in camera in quite a canny and cunning sort of way. There's also a transformation sequence later where Dr. Jekyll transforms into Sister Hyde behind a stained glass window, which has kind of got a ripply texture to it. So you see his face and her face behind a red rippled glass, stained glass window. And the transformation there kind of works as well. It's really interesting, the choices that Roy Ward Baker in particular made there to carry across the perception of that transformation. And they also do a lot of things with human hands as well, where Dr. Jekyll realizes he's changing into Sister Hyde because one of his hands becomes female, and conversely, Sister Hyde finds out she's changing back when one of her hands becomes male. So that's a kind of little, again, it's a little in-camera bit of business that kind of sells this thing as well. There is, of course, the titillation aspect of this film as well, where when the transformation first occurs and Sister Hyde fondles her own breast and finds how sensitive it is to stimulation. Martine Beswick plays the character really beautifully. She loves being a woman. She loves the fact that the transformation, and she doesn't want it to change. And she really does sell this one. I think we do get the tortured, kind of conflicted Dr. Jekyll from Ralph Bates, but it's Martine Beswick who really sells Sister Hyde as a person in her own right. And Martine Beswick was, of course, a beautiful woman. She's still around. Somebody told me on Facebook that she made a movie only a year or two ago. Yes, she has racked up a number of birthdays, but I liked her as an actor, and I liked her as Sister Hyde because she really did portray the character well. So there are two scenes with nudity in it. Apparently Hammer wanted some full frontal nudity, as indeed they portrayed in Demons of the Mind. But Martine Beswick didn't want to do it, and so we do get some kind of three-quarters from behind nudity for a moment, plus the breast fondling scene, to keep the certain members of the audience interested. I also like the titles at the start of this film. It's a really simple title thing. They've got some beautifully ornate Victorian English titles that come up. And in the background, there's just a red velvet curtain with a ledge on it. And on the left-hand side of the screen, a Victorian candlestick with a candle in it. It's not particularly portraying anything unless it's a slightly phallic symbol there. The red velvet meaning the female, the phallic looking candle meaning the male. I mean, that's a possibility there. But it's a simple kind of background and it works. There's some really good, lush music by David Whittaker, which makes it work. We also get a lot of the usual things you expect in a movie that essays Jack the Ripper, which is the cheerful strumpets on the streets of London, and you know, street singers singing in a pub. You get all of that kind of stuff, which is, as somebody mentions in one of the extras for this film, was really kind of a nod in the direction of a very successful musical, Lionel Bart's Oliver, that was done as a film a year or two before this. So it was kind of tapping into that zeitgeist just a little bit. And you get some kind of funny, slightly tongue-in-cheek dialogue. For instance, Gerald Sims' character at one stage says, "It's a queer business, Sergeant, very queer," to one of the policemen. And that's a kind of nod in the direction of the gender and sexuality issues that we get in the text. So that's kind of fun. It's also mentioned in the extras too that this has a lot of the same plot as an earlier Hammer film, not just a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde film, but a movie from the, I think, the late 50s or early 60s called The Man Who Could Cheat Death, starring Anton Differing, which is another Hammer film you should really see, because Anton Differing's quite interesting in it. And it's a movie also that uses colour in an interesting way. We get a blind guy in London too, running a hurdy-gurdy machine which plays music when you wind the handle on it, and who doesn't, who kind of senses that the person walking past him is the same character, even though at one stage it's a man and in other stages it's a woman, but doesn't quite know how that could occur. Now, there were a couple of other people that were considered for the role of Sister Hyde in particular, because they had Ralph Bates, they were going to invest in him as a replacement for Lee and Cushing in the Hammer stable. Kate O'Mara, another actor who has appeared in a few Hammer films, was considered. Julie Edge, who was in a few Hammer things and was quite an attractive Scandinavian woman, was considered. But when Martine Beswick came in, they realised quite quickly that she had a lot of facial similarity to Ralph Bates, and that's what sells this. The fact that they do look like they could be brother and sister really sells this movie, even though it's got an absurd conceit. But if you go into a cinema, or even if you slip a disc in or stream a Hammer horror movie, you're going to see absurd things all across the board. But that similarity of bone structure and looks, they've both got the same skin tone, the same kind of hair, really does make this work in a fascinating way. And all strength to Hammer for going that distance and waiting for the right person to come along for the role. We've got a couple of other things that kind of work. There's a character called Biker, played by Philip Murdoch, who's a morgue attendant. And it's really interesting, this character too, because he steers Dr. Jekyll in the direction of Burke and Hare. But he's also, he has a lot of dialogue in the morgue with Dr. Jekyll. And it's pretty clear from the dialogue that the Biker character, B-Y-K-E-R, Biker, is a necrophile and thinks at first that Dr. Jekyll is as well. So you've got that kind of slightly sickening character in there who's played slightly lightly and almost as a queasy kind of comic relief in there. And I kind of like that. It's one of those things where they just ram with the conceits in this film. The merging of different mythologies, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the Jack the Ripper, the Burke and Hare thing, and the gender change stuff. It really does cram a lot of stuff in as well. The other thing I was going to mention too is that Caroline Munro was considered for the role, but she declined because she didn't want to do the nudity in the film. But, yeah, I mean, you can respect that choice. It's not something that everybody's going to be comfortable with. That's not a direction that everybody would like their career to go in. So I totally understand that. But I think that Caroline Munro wouldn't have been as good in the role, possibly just because of her appearance, than Martine Beswick was. I think she was the perfect choice for the role. The other thing I really liked that really worked for me as far as a directorial choice was concerned is Roy Boyd-Baker did something interesting, because part of the London scene is a market area where a guy is gutting rabbits. Rabbits were cheap meat at the time, and it's very kind of right for that part of London to have a butcher gutting rabbits. And Roy Ward-Baker cross-cuts between the Jack the Ripper stabbings of these young women and, you know, street sex workers and the guy gutting a rabbit. And it really does kind of work. I really like that. It's a kind of slightly bold and slightly naughty choice to make there, cross-cutting between the two of them. But rather than going the full-on torture porn, which wouldn't have passed the censorship anyway, they made that kind of smart choice. One of the interesting things about censorship for me is it does sometimes lead to really interesting results as people try to circumvent it. Now, it's not something that kind of was new to this particular film, but it is something you do see in a lot of films up to this day, where you'll see, you know, somebody about to smash someone's head in with a hammer, and then they'll cross cut to somebody accidentally dropping a watermelon off a cart, so that you get the watermelon splatter instead of the head splatter. It's a common conceit, but it's done very well in this movie, and it's cross-cut several times between the two scenes, you know, the raising of the knife and then the stabbing down of the knife and the guy gutting the rabbit. And, yeah, I kind of liked that. It was cool. But just to kind of wind this up, the bottom line is Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde were both murderous people in this film. So the idea that somebody who is transgendered is murderous, I can understand where people come from in that. It's a very deeply held part of certain people's lives, and I respect that entirely. But this movie, I kind of like the way that they approached it. I don't think, you know, and also one of the interesting things is that Sister Hyde is a much more interesting human being than Dr. Jekyll is. Dr. Jekyll's very kind of repressed and focused on his work and boring as fuck. But Sister Hyde is much more life-embracing, which is kind of cool and does lead in the direction of somebody finding their true self being happier, even if they are going to end up stabbing a lot of people. So that's about it for this time around. I really did enjoy visiting these two Hammer films. I've got a lot more from that stash that I bought, so I may well do future episodes, not too distant future episodes, doing Hammer double features. Let me know if you want me to do that, because I just love Hammer horror films. They're of their time. They're silly, they're light entertainment. There's nothing deep and meaningful really in them, but they are, on the whole, vastly entertaining. Thanks for listening. I am going to do, of course, the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and show some love to the people who support the podcast at patreon.com/paleocinema. So thank you very much to the supporters. By the way, there's still time to get in for the big giveaway that I'm doing for April, where I'm throwing a whole bunch of stuff into a box and giving it away. I am doing an overseas one and a local one, so I'm looking forward to putting those ones together in April to celebrate my birthday and giving them out at random to Patreon supporters. So you've still got time to throw a few bucks at me, and I may well throw a whole bunch of movie-related stuff at you. I am also going to, after the credits, play one of Gillian Hills, the actress from Demons of the Mind, one of her Yeah Yeah hits from the French pop charts in the 1960s. It's a track called Zooby Zooby Zoo, and it's really kind of cool. So I'll put the credits up now, and then I'll play you a little bit of 1960s French Yeah Yeah music by Gillian Hills. Anyway, look after yourselves. Watch some good movies. Watch some bad movies. Keep watching the skies and take care of yourselves until the next time. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip. Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler. Elaine, our scientific advisor. Julia, the casting director. Chris, the camera operator. Christopher, the gaffer. Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress. Tansy, our foley artist. Alyssa, our location scout. Mark, the second unit director. Paul, the special makeup effects director. Tammy, the donut wrangler. Tim, our New York unit director. Steve, our spiritual advisor. Steve Sullivan, our script doctor. Dylan, the goat wrangler. Eric, the set security lead. Richard H., the set photographer. Mark D., the extra. David L., the extra. And Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.
Mois